Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at. The Supreme Court kicks Illinois' assault weapons ban down the road. Plus, we unpack the High Court's decision on presidential immunity and what it could mean going forward.
On Route 66, he put his life back together.
And a new exhibition from a photojournalist with a deep connection to a famous roadway. And now to some of today's top stories. The U.S. Supreme Court won't take up a challenge to Illinois' assault weapons ban, at least not right now. That law was passed in the wake of the July 4th parade mass shooting in Highland Park 2 years ago. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the ban last year. Earlier today, the U.S. Supreme Court denied a request to hear the cases, but with Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas making clear they'd be willing to take up the issue. Thomas wrote that the Second Amendment cannot become a, quote, second-class right. We'll have more on this in a moment with our Spotlight Politics team. Chicago's Police Accountability Agency releases video of an officer fatally shooting a man earlier this year. Tracy Watson was killed by police in South Austin in May. Body cam footage shows him apparently trying to stab another man and ignoring commands to drop his weapon, at which point officers fired. Watson was killed and the other man was wounded. Watson's family has reportedly said he was acting in self-defense and that he and two cousins had been attacked before the shooting. We've got much more about this story, including the full video, on our website. And more street closures are ahead as preparation for this weekend's NASCAR street race continue. New shutdowns took effect this morning along Congress, with most major street closures expected to be in place by this Friday ahead of the Saturday and Sunday event. And if you're looking for some non-NASCAR holiday weekend activity, Millennium Park, the Lakefront Trail, and the major museums will be open. We've got a guide to help you get there on our website. Up next, presidential power in the wake of a major court decision. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Former President Donald Trump's sentencing over hush money payments is on hold for another 2 months after the Supreme Court rules presidents have broad immunity from prosecution. That 6-3 ruling dramatically expands the power of the president with the decision that they cannot be charged for official acts. The decision was sparked by another of Trump's indictments over charges he tried to subvert the 2020 election. Trump immediately celebrated the ruling as a big win for the country, but many Democratic leaders and dissenting justices on the court called the decision a dangerous precedent that could create dictator-like powers. Joining us to discuss this are Carolyn Shapiro, professor of law and co-director of the Institute on the Supreme Court at Illinois Tech's Chicago Kent College of Law. She also clerked for Justice Stephen Breyer. And joining us by Zoom is Ashley Keller, a senior partner at Keller Postman. He also clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy. Thank you both very much for being with us. Carolyn Shapiro, I'd like to start with you, please. Former President Trump has been facing multiple legal challenges. Remind us the background of the case that the Supreme Court just ruled on.
Well, the background is January 6th and events leading up to it. And the indictment charges him in various ways of conspiring to or attempting to essentially overthrow the election. The legal charges are slightly more technical than that, but that's what the case is about. And that's what the Supreme Court today said, at least as to some of the actions that he took. He has absolute immunity. As to some of the actions that he took, he had, or that are alleged, he has presumptive immunity, which the prosecutor may be able to overcome. And that there may be some unofficial acts for which he has no immunity, but they did not say that any of the acts he's alleged to have, or that we all witnessed him do, were unofficial acts.
Yeah, we've got a bit of the decision that says the president enjoys no immunity for his unofficial acts, and not everything the president does is official. The president is not above the law. It goes on to say Congress may not criminalize the president's conduct in carrying out the responsibilities of the executive branch under the Constitution. What was your reaction to that decision?
Well, my reaction is this decision is extraordinarily broad. There may well be things for which the president should have immunity, and there are a variety of ways to get there. But this opinion says that not only does the president have absolute immunity for certain acts, it defines that range of acts extremely broadly, and it says that and so there's no possibility of allegations there. So, for example, his conversations with the Justice Department, the court says, are part of his core constitutional functions, and therefore he has absolute immunity. Two other things the court said that were really problematic. One is that the motive that the president has or is alleged to have is irrelevant when determining whether an act is official or unofficial. So the fact that he had a corrupt motive to try to overturn the election is irrelevant to the immunity determination. And finally, they said that the acts for which he is immune cannot be entered even as evidence in any trial against him.
Ashley Keller, I'd like to bring you in, please. What's your reaction to the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, thanks. So I have a little bit of a different reaction. Let me give your listeners a hypothetical. If Congress passed a law saying that WTTW could not post this broadcast because Congress disagrees with your political bent, and if this broadcast did go forward, anybody who was involved in it would be punished by 10 years in prison, you would be immune from prosecution if you nevertheless went forward with this broadcast, because the First Amendment would render that law unconstitutional. And the same principle is what the Supreme Court is picking up here under Article 2 of the Constitution. If Congress passes a law saying the president shall go to jail for 10 years if he vetoes any legislation that Congress passes, of course that would be unconstitutional. The president of the United States has a core executive prerogative to veto legislation. Let's talk about what Professor Shapiro just discussed. The president of the United States is vested with all of the executive power. Of course, he has a core constitutional prerogative to consult with the attorney general about whether to prosecute election fraud. And it doesn't matter whether you think he's right about the election fraud, just like it doesn't matter whether you think he should veto the legislation or not. So the principle in play here is that the Constitution of the United States, which defines the scope of the president's executive authority, is supreme law over any criminal statute. Of course, the president's not a king. We don't have a monarchy today when we yesterday thought we had a constitutional republic. The Supreme Court draws that line quite clearly. But Professor Shapiro is obviously correct. It doesn't go through and delineate all of the things that are official conduct versus unofficial conduct. That's because the Supreme Court is a court of review, not first view. It sent it back to the Obama-appointed district court judge to make those determinations in the first instance, and that's entirely appropriate for the Supreme Court to do.
So, Ashley, do you see this as an expansion of presidential power, or is this the court simply delineating, you know, power or immunity that already existed?
Yeah, I don't think it's an expansion of executive power at all. The determination about whether the president has immunity hinges on the president exercising his constitutional Article II prerogatives. So he's only going to get immunity when he's acting pursuant to the official powers that he's given by the people of the United States. It doesn't expand those powers one bit.
And Carolyn Shapiro, talking about those sort of core constitutional powers, how broad a set of authority are we talking about here?
Well, I'd agree that there are some. So I would agree with the hypothetical about vetoing laws, that Congress cannot criminalize the president vetoing certain laws. But I completely disagree that the president cannot be subject to criminal laws. The president is obligated to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That is one of his obligations. And the majority in this case has actually turned that obligation on its head by saying that when the president says that he's acting to take care that the law be properly executed, he's actually immune from prosecution for anything that he does. And that seems to me to be the opposite of taking care that the law be faithfully executed.
You know, should President Trump be reelected, could he simply instruct the Justice Department to drop these subversion charges?
Well, he could do that anyway.
Yeah.
That was true before this ruling. So if he is reelected, he would have done that before, and he will do that regardless of the immunity ruling below.
Ashley Keller, are you confident that there are enough checks and balances in place on presidential authority, on the prerogative that they have?
I think that the presidency has expanded quite a bit in terms of its prerogative. I think that we should get back to the core of Article II. So I have problems with the modern presidency. I don't think that that has anything specific to do with President Trump. I think this has been a creeping issue for quite some time. So no, I'm not confident about that, but it has nothing to do with the decision that issued the other day.
Carolyn Shapiro, the justices sent this case back to the lower court to determine which acts in the indictment are official, which are unofficial. Do we have any idea what that process entails?
We really don't. They gave actually surprisingly little guidance to the lower courts about how to make that determination. And I will say, I am surprised that they could say that his conversations with members of the Justice Department were absolutely immune, and could not say that, for example, his speech on the Ellipse on January 6th was an unofficial act. That was an act designed to keep him in power after January 20th, 2021. That cannot be an official act. So I was surprised by that. And they did not give any guidance to the lower court about how to take into account the fact that that's what this was all about trying to overthrow a free and fair election.
We've got about a minute left. Ashley Keller, you know, a Gallup poll found about 40% of folks approve of the Supreme Court, and an all-time low. Is this the kind of case that could affect public trust in the justices?
I don't know. I'm not a good pollster or a politician. I'm more of a law nerd, so I probably want to stick in my lane. But I do want to say the Supreme Court of the United States here got briefing from both sides that was very absolute. Trump said he can do whatever he wants. The Justice Department essentially said he can't do anything. He can be prosecuted even for official acts. And so the Supreme Court had to reject both of those positions. They had to do it on a truncated timetable. There was no way they could dodge this case. It's obviously a crucially important case, and so they had to hear it. And they chose a middle ground and then left for the lower court to decide in the first instance what to do with the broad principles they announced. I understand Professor Shapiro's frustration that they didn't give a detailed roadmap about how to do it, but it's not their fault that the parties didn't brief these issues, and so they're sending it back down, as they always do in the first instance, to the district court.
And I know we will have much more to talk about as this case progresses, but that's where we'll have to leave it for right now. Ashley Keller, Carolyn Shapiro, thank you both very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, mounting debt, rising taxes, and more in our Spotlight Politics segment. Stay with us. The Supreme Court passes on hearing the case against Illinois' assault weapons ban for now. Meanwhile, Chicago's growing pension debt and Independence Day drivers beware. No, not NASCAR. A bump in the gas tax is here. All that and much more in our Spotlight Politics. I'm here with the team, Amanda Vinicky and Heather Sharon. Good to see you both.
You too.
So as we've been talking about tonight, Supreme Court passed on that assault weapons challenge, but Justice Thomas wants the court to take the case when it's fully baked. Amanda, what the details there?
Yeah, we also had evidently Justice Alito saying that he would have taken this up right now. This is a case that really harkens back to timely, unfortunate, tragic 2 years ago when there was a horrific massacre, really, at a 4th of July parade in Highland Park that led Illinois 6 months later to pass what's broadly known as an assault weapons ban. The terminology gun rights activists take umbrage with, saying that these are common guns, such as the AR-15, that are being banned by this law. And that's, in fact, part of the argument that you heard Justice Thomas say. wait, if there's a law that is going to make illegal and does in fact make illegal one of the most common guns in the United States, we need to deal with that. Really what it comes down to is the lower courts are still dealing with this. You've had a variety of mixed opinions, including one that did not rule on the constitutionality of the actual Second Amendment rights of this case. So really, we're still seeing what goes forward here, but it means for now that this gun control measure, which puts a ban on really hundreds of guns, as well as a cap on the number of magazines that can be purchased and used, that remains in place for now.
And it seems like, because it's a fairly complex case, the timeline here is pretty murky in terms of if it ever makes it up to the Supreme Court, where things go next.
Yeah, we don't have any sort of timeline. Well, you don't know what the courts are going to do or when.
You sure don't. Heather, Chicago's unfunded pension debt up nearly 5%, about $2 billion to $37.2 billion. How big a problem is this for mayor and city leaders? Seems like an obvious question, but I have to ask.
Well, it is a very big problem because finances is a zero-sum game. If you have to spend next year close to $30 billion just to sort of service the debt, there's a lot less you can do in terms of programs like mental health care or additional violence interruption or any of the things that Mayor Brandon Johnson campaigned on. The only slightly good news in this report out this week, which is the city's annual financial report, was that the share of the pension, the pensions are a bit better funded this year than they were last year. Last year they were 24% funded. It's all the way up to a grand spanking total of 26% funded.
Hot dog.
And let's keep in mind that the city spent an extra $300 million this year to sort of make sure that the pensions didn't get even worse.
And is there a sense of urgency to find some new revenue sources to help pay down that debt?
There sure is. And the city is sort of entering what we like to refer to as budget season. It's not just a thing, it's a time of year. And they will start trying to figure out how to make ends meet, because really for decades the city's finances have been out of whack, not solely because of pensions, but it is a large part of the problem.
And I know budget season is your favorite of
it
all
is.
The seasons.
Yes. I still like summer best.
You and me both. Some new laws just went into effect yesterday, including an increase on the gas tax just in time for holiday travel. Amanda, what should folks be expecting to pay, and where are those tax dollars going to go?
Holiday travel, and I believe it's supposed to hit yet another record post-COVID. Everybody wants to hit the road, go somewhere, and now if you fill up your tank, at least in Illinois, and this is always a point of contention, particularly with legislators who represent communities that are on the border, say, of Wisconsin or Iowa, that people aren't going to get their gas in Illinois. Instead, they'll travel to one of those states because it's going to cost an extra 2 cents a gallon. That's just the law. That's how it goes. It pays actually for the roads. And so when you're looking at, you know, potholes and repairs on the highways, that's what the extra money at the pump goes toward. But it's going to be coming, I guess, right at the great time to hurt taxpayers in their wallets, or motorists anyway, but it'll be to the benefit of the state budget.
All right. Well, this is a very money-heavy segment tonight, but Chicago's tipped workers also seeing their wages rise. It's part of a slow ramp-up to parity with minimum wage in 4 years. Heather, do you think it's likely increased labor costs are going to mean steeper bills for restaurant patrons?
Well, restaurant owners are really worried about this because this sort of starts to shift the burden from diners and patrons to sort of make up the salaries for waiters and waitresses from the patrons themselves to the restaurants themselves. So everybody's supposed to get at least the minimum wage, which also went up. And if restaurant workers don't get that in tips, the restaurant owners are supposed to make that up. Whether they do or don't always is a point of contention. But this is really sort of the centerpiece of Mayor Brandon Johnson's sort of labor agenda in his first year in office. And he says this is really about equity and that people should not have to sort of expose themselves to sort of having to flirt with customers or sort of live and die on sort of their tips to live sort of a financially secure life.
Well, it has been a huge political story the last few days after the president's shaky debate performance last week. A lot of nervous Dems gathering for calls about the upcoming election, including Governor Pritzker, who's standing by the candidate so far. Amanda, do we know any of the details of those conversations?
We just know that Governor Pritzker was part of a call with other Democratic governors yesterday and is set to be on a call tomorrow with the president himself. This would be via Zoom or whatever video platform they use, not an in-person meeting. But we don't necessarily have an agenda. We just know that there are a lot of nervous Democrats. As you noted, Nick, the governor has certainly been standing by his man. That is not unexpected, particularly given that his name is on the medium list. I don't know if about quite short list, but at least on the medium list for potential replacements if something were to happen at the very, very top of the ticket. So you're not going to see Pritzker being the one to speak up trying to out Biden.
We've got about 15 seconds left. Today was the first Democratic official to publicly call on Biden to step down. Heather, put your prediction cap on. Are we going to see any more?
So we just heard the president speak at sort of an event saying that he was tired from all of the international travel that he had made and that he didn't think it would be a fatal flaw to his campaign. So he certainly hopes he's the last.
All right. Well, time will tell. Always a pleasure to see the two of you. Amanda Vinicky, Heather Sharone. Thank you. Up next, how a photographer's life and work intersected with an iconic highway. For Edward Keating, a one-off assignment to photograph Route 66 turned into a years-long labor of love. An award-winning photojournalist, Keating also had a deep personal connection to the famous roadway. Now, his work highlighting a more complicated side of the highway, memorialized in that famous tune, is being shown at Uptown's Chicago Center for Photojournalism. What could be more classic Americana than Route 66? One of the country's original highways, starting in Illinois and running through the Midwest, Southwest, and into California. But photographer Edward Keating didn't take such a rosy view of the roadway.
So it was really important for him not just to document the vistas and the beautiful backdrops of Route 66 from Chicago to LA, but really document the people, that many of whom were left behind, people that moved here for, you know, with so many hopes and dreams, and a lot of those dreams were shattered. He wanted to document the reality of this highway, not just get your kicks on Route 66.
And for Keating, Route 66 wasn't just a highway. It was a place to heal while he was on the road during a chaotic time in his life.
He was about 21 years old with a major drinking problem, just finding himself on Route 66. And it was the place that he really hit rock bottom. But at the same time, not too long after that, on Route 66, he put his life back together.
He got sober and made a career as a photographer. Keating spent years on the staff of the New York Times. He worked for weeks at Ground Zero as part of its Pulitzer Prize-winning photography team.
It was nice to have that acknowledgement, but that's never why he did it. You know, he covered the Kosovo War. He was always running after tough things in life because he just felt like someone had to document it, and he felt like it had to be him.
One of those things Keating felt called to document was the reality of Route 66. From 2000 to 2011, Keating made multiple trips, traveled thousands of miles, and took tens of thousands of photographs.
He actually didn't even develop a lot of the work. He always said that the best part about photography for him was just actually taking the picture, not even actually seeing the image in the end.
In 2018, Keating published the book Main Street, The Lost Dream of Route 66. He died in 2021 at age 65 of cancer he believed was from exposure to toxic dust at the ruins of the World Trade Center.
Before that, he stressed how important it was for him to show this work, especially along Route 66, because this work, he said when he published it in the book, he didn't own it anymore.
The Chicago stop is one of several exhibitions along Route 66 organized by Keating's daughter, Caitlin, a documentary filmmaker, and his wife, Carrie, also a photographer. Caitlin says bringing her father's work to galleries along the historic highway offers a chance to show the realities of lost jobs, limited opportunities, struggling small towns, and the sense of hope and humanity that pervades even the most challenging pictures.
Some of these images are really hard to look at. And I just hope that people really still take the time to look and don't turn away. Because if we do, we're going to forget about the past.
So how does it feel to be here and see all this work up on the walls?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel so emotional. I got full chills when I walked in because, you know, this is exactly what he wanted. It just means so much to my entire family. And the only sad part is that he's not here, but we know that he would be so, so happy with how it turned out.
Main Street, the lost dream of Route 66, runs at the Chicago Center for Photojournalism through July 29th. And we've got the details on our website. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing newsletter and join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Concerns over age in the race for president, but how much does that matter in running the country? And why some homeowners in the south suburbs are seeing the largest property tax increase in 30 years. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its founder and senior partner, Robert Clifford, who ranked number one in the state of Illinois by Super Lawyers Top 10 2024 Illinois Super Lawyers List.